Now on RT Radio 1, it's time for The Book Show.
Welcome to The Book Show with me, Sinead Gleeson. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Bookshow RTE. And on the show this evening, we hear about John Freeman's obsession with John Updike and how he's learned to read a novelist.
That dream and his books and what those books meant to me all collided with an encounter.
And we take a literary tour through London.
Fiction, which is rooted in a place and a time, can tell you as much about everyday life than any other form of material.
But now, Jojo Moyes is a British author who's had considerable success both commercially and critically. Her last novel, Me Before You, was a bestseller, and her new novel is set for equal success. The 1+1 centres on a single mother, Jess Thomas, and her two children, Tansy, who's gifted with numbers, and stepson Nicky, who's being bullied. Jojo Moyes joined me from London recently to tell us about The 1+1.
Essentially, it's a love story and a road trip about a slightly chaotic modern family. I just always loved road trips. I love the movies about them. And I just wanted to write something that had that sense of kind of tragicomedy and encompassed a whole lot of people who perhaps wouldn't normally have been together, thrust into the close confines of a little car.
I think the subject as well, the idea that working parents, we're all under an awful lot of pressure, but I'm guessing maybe you didn't have to look too far to get a sense of a parent sort of juggling work and children.
Oh, yeah. I'm a mother of three, and it's been a never-ending juggling process. I'm never quite sure I've got it right. But yeah, I wanted to write something about mothers and working and, just the pressures that a lot of families are under with regards to money and time. You know, there's one point where Jess thinks about what a great mother she could be if she just had the time to sit down with her kids on the sofa instead of always saying, yeah, I've just got to load the dishwasher, I've just got to clean this, or I've just got to put the washing on. And I think most of us can identify with that feeling.
The feeling of the hamster wheel, absolutely. Do you think it's surprising that more fiction doesn't actually deal with these family dynamics?
Do you know, that's exactly it. I started writing this and I suddenly thought, I don't think normal, perhaps slightly skint families get much of a voice in fiction unless they're kind of really problematic. And it just doesn't reflect what I see around me where I live. There are just loads of people who don't have a lot of money, but are just getting by slightly heroically against the odds. And there's a lot of humour and a lot of love in those families. And I just wanted to write about one of those families that perhaps wasn't traditional, wasn't something you usually see in fiction.
Well, Jess, who's the main character in that family, it's a working class family. She's working class and she works as a cleaner, and she gets to be around a lot of people who have money, people like Ed, who's very wealthy. Also, we've had this before with Louisa and Will in Me Before You. But the idea of class distinction, it does reoccur in your work. Do you think money, when you put it into a novel, naturally creates tension and leaves room for drama?
Yeah, Me Before You was definitely about class, but I would say that The 1+1 is about money. It's about the growing difference between the haves and the have-nots in this country. And it occurred to me the other day when I was walking through a London street that I knew as a kid, that nowadays the most contact a lot of those families in the big houses would have with somebody who earned, say, less than £20,000 a year would only be their cleaner. And it just really hit me that the way these two worlds, the people in them just do not understand the pressures each other are under. And so I kind of wanted to explore that, not in a heavy-handed political way, but just through the act of throwing these people together.
In terms of how you steer the story along, you use the road trip as a way of bringing all the characters together. How does it make, or how does it help them to actually break free? How does it change them?
Well, you know, there's nothing like being stuck next to somebody for a long period. As you know, if you've ever got on a long-haul plane journey, by the end of it, you either loathe the person next to you or you know their entire family history. And I just thought it was a really useful way of the people not being able to get away from each other and having to learn to accommodate each other. Whether it's something as kind of minor as one person fidgeting a lot or the dog that kind of ruins the car interior with his slobber, but also just having to have your own attitudes, your own unthinking attitudes, like Ed's attitudes towards money, challenged slightly by realising what the family next to him is facing.
And I think to get a sense of that, are we there yet, tension, let's hear a section from The 1+1, if you'll read it first now, Jo.
So this is the very first part of the journey when Ed, who is a sort of failed dot-com whiz kid, has rashly agreed to take this funny little family to Scotland in his car. The traffic cleared and they headed out onto the dual carriageway. Ed put his foot down. It was a beautiful day and he was tempted to take the coast road, but he didn't want to risk getting caught in traffic again. "The sat-nav reckons about 8 hours if we don't hit jams," he said. "By motorway?" "Well, yeah," he glanced left. "Even a top-of-the-range Audi doesn't have wings." "There's a bit of a problem." "A problem?" "Tansy gets sick if we go fast." "What do you mean fast? 80? 90? Actually, 50. Okay, maybe 40. Ed glanced into the rearview mirror. Was it his imagination or had the child grown a little paler? She'll be fine. This car is brand new. It has award-winning suspension. Nobody gets sick in it." Jess looked straight ahead. "You don't have kids, do you?" "Why do you ask?" "No reason." It took 25 minutes to disinfect and shampoo the back seat, and even then, every time he put his head inside the interior, Ed got a faint whiff of something unpleasant. "So," he said, "Scotland it is, via B roads."
And that was Jojo Moyes reading there from The One Plus One. In terms of the idea of a road trip, it occurs in a lot of fiction. Are there novels that you particularly enjoyed that feature road trips?
Well, there's a very funny book called Are We There Yet by Ben Hatch, which I read a couple of years ago. But that was a true story about his attempts to drive his family around Britain. But I love the film Little Miss Sunshine, which featured another kind of quirky family on a road trip. And I like the fact that both those things were not necessarily sentimental, but they were very funny and they were about essentially loving families.
You're also quite far along your own journey in terms of writing. I think this is your 12th novel. Do you think as you get more successful, and Me Before You was hugely successful, does it get easier or more difficult to get up and write in the morning? And has it changed who you are as a writer from those very early days?
I don't think it has. I think the stakes get a bit higher. But you know what? Having written kind of 7 or 8 books that only had moderate success, having a big success is better. It really is. It's much more fun. I don't feel it's changed me as a writer, but it's really, really nice to know that what you're writing might definitely have a readership. That feels a lot better because, you know, before it felt really terrifying not knowing, you know, book by book whether anyone was going to read it.
And I think there is a big readership for women's fiction, which has been often called that awful pejorative term, chick lit. Do you think in a way that it's been, you know, commercial women's fiction has been less respected and maybe a little bit sort of considered lesser than literary fiction when compared?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think one of the things for me personally that has been the most interesting development is that since the advent of e-readers, I've had so many more male readers contact me. And I think it's because, you know, freed from the pink cover, they feel that they can just read the story. And, you know, most literature has a love story at its heart. It doesn't mean that it's necessarily chick lit or women's fiction. It's just books about the human condition and love being, you know, one of the things that we're all mildly obsessed by. So for me, that says something to me. It says that, you know, perhaps the marketing doesn't need to be as gender specific as it is. And I'm really grateful to the e-reader thing, having been initially quite suspicious of them, because it seems to have opened up my books, and I'm sure it's worked for a lot of other women writers as well, to male readers.
Who don't want to be caught seeing reading certain books on the tube, I guess.
Yeah, they don't want to be seen with a pink cover. And, you know, I can understand that. I probably, you know, much as I hate to admit my own prejudices, I'd probably raise an eyebrow if I saw a man sitting there reading something that was a pink glittery book.
And thanks to Jojo Moyes, The One Plus One is published by Penguin. Now, on a recent trip to London, Zoe Cummins went on a literary tour of the city with Andrew Whitehead, who runs the website londonfictions.com. On the site, there's a huge amount of information about scores of novels set in the capital. Zoe went to find out about 3 of those novels: A Child of the Jago by Arthur Morrison, The Lonely Londoners by Samuel Sulvan, and Brick Lane by Monica Ali.
I'm here in London with Andrew Whitehead. And Andrew, you're going to bring me on a literary tour of London today. And we're going to talk about 3 different books. We're starting off in Shoreditch. But can you tell me a little bit about why you've chosen these 3 books and why they typify London?
All 3 novels that we're going to look at have a very strong sense of place. Not of London, but of a locality and a community within London. And I think, as a reader, and a little bit as a historian as well, that fiction, which is rooted in a place and a time, can tell you as much about everyday life and attitudes at that place and at that time than any other form of material. So we're starting off in the 1890s, and we're going to come more or less up to date. The area that we're looking out on, which is now full of sort of 1890s mansion blocks, this is a London County Council estate, the Boundary Street estate, one of the first. Before these houses were built, it was one of the most notorious slums in London. It was called the Nickel, and that's what Arthur Morrison in his novel, which came out in 1896, called the Jago. And he portrayed it as a real sink of iniquity. Terrible housing, damp, multi-occupation, run by gangs, where no honest kid had a chance of growing up good. And in particular, it's about a young boy, Dickie Perrott, born in the slum, who aspires to be good, but is trapped by the slum, by circumstances, by the street culture here. He tries to go honest, but he's sort of adopted almost by a fence, and he goes out thieving. And in the end, his father is hanged, and Dickie Perrott, I hope I'm not going to spoil this for people who are going to read the book, Dickie Perrott is stabbed to death. And that was based on a true life incident where a youngster here who lived here in the 1890s was indeed stabbed to death.
Offshore to Chai Street, a narrow passage set across with posts gave menacing entrance to one end of old Jago Street, to where the other end lost itself in the black beyond Jago Row. There, the Jago, for 100 years, the blackest pit in London, lay and festered. Halfway along old Jago Street, a narrow archway gave upon Jago Court, the blackest hole in all that pit.
So this is Boundary Passage. It featured in the novel as the post is, and you can still see in front of us there are posts and bollards which would certainly have been there in the 1890s. In the novel, High Street, far end, Dickie Perrott would nick goods from the market stalls in the High Street, and he would run hell for leather down this passage into the slum. Once he's past the posts, he's basically safe. The police would be very nervous to pursue him. And I think it's a wonderfully atmospheric spot.
So we're going to leave Boundary Passage now, and you're going to take me all the way up to around the 1950s. Where are we off to?
We're going to go to Waterloo Station. It's about, I suppose, 2 or 3 miles from here, right in the centre of London. And it's where the boat trains used to arrive in the 1950s, bringing migrants from the Caribbean when they got off the boat. And it's where the opening to a really wonderful novel is set. The novel is Sam Sullivan's The Lonely Londoners.
So we've come from the Jago and we're here in Waterloo Station, where the opening passage of The Lonely Londoners is set.
That's right, and I can't come to Waterloo Station without remembering that passage. It's wonderful. Moses Alouetta, who's a Trinidadian who's just settled in London, is on the bus from Notting Hill to come here to Waterloo to meet a friend from Trinidad off the boat train. So Caribbean migrants would get the boat to the UK, they'd probably arrive at Tilbury, they'd get on a special train, and that train would drop them here at Waterloo.
One grim winter evening, when it had a kind of unrealness about London, with a fog sleeping restlessly over the city, and the lights showing in the blur as if not London at all, but some strange place on another planet, Moses Alouetta hop on a number 46 bus at the corner of Chepstow Road and Westbourne Grove to go to Waterloo to meet a feller who was coming from Trinidad on the boat train.
He knows that he's going to have to meet this guy and then look after him and probably put him up, find him somewhere to live, find him a job. And the novel is all about the network that Caribbean migrants, male migrants, set up to survive as lonely Londoners in this new city. And Sam Sullivan, the author, was himself from the Caribbean. He came to London in 1950. And this is the first major novel about post-war black migration to London.
You talk about, in The Lonely Londoners, people coming together to find a way through this new community and new city that they're in. Is there a sense, though, that they're forced to be together because nobody else wants them around, and therefore there's a forced identity?
Unmistakably so. So the Caribbean migrants initially all congregated in the same part of London, so Moses Alouetta and his mates all live in that Notting Hill, Westbourne Grove area, which is now very, very posh. It was then slum housing, subdivided. But of course it was men who came, coming in often in their early 20s, mid-20s. They left their wives and girlfriends at home. So you've got thousands of young Caribbean men in London and very sexually frustrated.
So we're going to leave Waterloo Station now and the lonely Londoners behind and go to a very different part of London, Brick Lane, from the 1950s to the 1990s.
That's right. So Lonely Londoners is about the first big post-war migration to London, and Brick Lane is about one of the more recent migrations of people from Bangladesh. And Brick Lane in the East End was where the Bengalis did and do congregate.
So we're looking at a sign here of Brick Lane, and underneath, actually, which you don't see very often, is Brick Lane written in Bengali.
That's right. All the street signs around here have got the Bengali version underneath. But, you know, if you look at the street signs here, look, there's a Bangladeshi restaurant there. It's got the sign in English and in Bengali as well. This is the most Bengali part of Britain, and it's called Banglatan.
We're now sort of almost all the way down Brick Lane. And, of course, most people know Brick Lane because of Monica Ali's novel of the same name.
And that novel, which was shortlisted for the Booker when it came out in 2003, is set exactly here. People here didn't like it. The novel is about a woman, Nazneen, who marries a much older man and lives in a housing estate very close to here. And she's trapped in the house. She doesn't learn English. She doesn't work outside the home. She is a very submissive, traditional Bangladeshi wife.
I always said, I will not marry and be sent far away. But our mother chose me an educated man, living abroad. My sister would stay, I would go. If Allah wanted us to ask questions, He would have made us men.
And then things start to change. Her husband, who is very confident and bullish, starts to lose his confidence. He loses any hope of a career. He starts working as a cab driver. He starts talking about going back to Bangladesh. She discovers herself, and the thing that people here didn't particularly like, she has an affair with a young Bangladeshi man who is a radicalized Muslim. And that's what caught the controversy. So a lot of people here made a lot of fuss when there was a plan to film Brick Lane along these streets.
People just said no.
People didn't like it, you know, there was a great deal of anger that the community was being misrepresented. I don't think it was a universal opinion, but it was quite a strongly expressed opinion among Bengalis living in this area.
So we've been today, we've been in Shoreditch High Street, we've looked at the slums of the late 19th century, we've travelled all the way through the 1950s, and we've ended up in Brick Lane. Is that story of the working class and immigration really the story of London?
It's not the full story of London, and there are lots of Hampstead novels about the white upper middle class at dinner parties. The London that grabs me, though, in fiction, and I suppose in life as well, is the grittier end. So it's about Jewish migration in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It's about the tensions that resulted from that in the 1930s. It's about Caribbean migration in the 1950s. And I think it's novels, contemporary novels, such as Brick Lane, which are about London becoming comfortable as a cosmopolitan city.
Thanks to Zoe Cummins and Andrew Whitehead for the London Fictions Tour. And to find out more about A Child of the Jago by Arthur Morrison, The Lonely Londoners by Samuel Sullivan, or Brick Lane by Monica Ali, all you've got to do is go to londonfictions.com or find them in your local bookshop. Now, John Freeman left his editorship of the critically acclaimed Granta magazine in 2013 to become a writer himself. He spent 5 years editing the work of new and established writers, but before that had spent almost 20 years interviewing writers about their own work. He has a self-confessed John Updike obsession, so it was fitting that the intro to his first book, How to Read a Novelist, would include Updike. The book brings together dozens of the interviews John Freeman has done over the years with writers such as David Foster Wallace, Toni Morrison and Philip Roth. But the collection itself starts with a beautifully crafted piece paying homage to John Updike and how he shaped Freeman's life.
One book led to another, and before long my Updike appreciation had turned into a mania. I amassed an almost complete set of first editions of his books, more than 50 in all. I was just missing his Tales for Children. And my girlfriend, bemused but never smitten by Updike, often accompanied me to bookstores to get them signed. When I decided I too wanted to be a writer, I did what Updike had done 40 years before me. I quit New York and moved with my girlfriend into a white clapboard house in New England. She took a job in technology research, and I began to write. Only I didn't. Instead, I spent my time reading Updike. aware that at my age, he had published a volume of light verse and a short novel. At night, I would occasionally look at the shelves in our bedroom and worry they might collapse from the black weight of their content and smother us in our sleep.
All that writers want to do is create these worlds and write fiction and do what they do, which is write books. So is it unfair of any of us, even though we're interested, to expect them to have this public side where they have to come into the world and out of their solitary rooms and talk to us?
Yeah, sure. If they're Thomas Pynchon or J.D. Salinger or any number of the people who've just opted out of it. But I think the novelists today understand that they're working in a breaking down media environment where books have fewer places to live in bookstores. There are fewer places to be written about. So more and more, they have to come out as the representative of their book. And yes, it's completely anathemical to what they do to make the book, which is to sit alone and dream things. But I think some of them do feel a sense of relief when they can finally get out of that room and come out and meet their readers. And an interviewer is like the person who brings them from the green room onto the stage and asks them a few questions along the way.
In your book, How to Read a Novelist, you have a very interesting encounter with John Updike.
I was a huge Updike fan from a very young age. And when I started to interview people, he was one of the writers I most wanted to speak to. And I did eventually with a novel about an interview called Seek My Face. And he's had some very interesting thoughts about what it meant to come out as a representative of his book. Because when he began publishing in the 1950s, you turned the book in, you were done. That was the end of your job. And he was at the end of his life realizing that that was the beginning of his job. And he was very nice and kind and gentle about it. But I also, as a person, idolized Updike. He was the sort of living dream of a writer's life, at a remove from a city, these sort of books coming down off this lofty mountain every 9 months or so. And so at one point, that dream and his books and what those books meant to me and how they echoed in my own life all collided with an encounter. I decided to propose, which meant I needed a ring. For the last time, I turned to Updike. I had gone through periodic purges of my shelves, attacking my bibliophilia like a cancer that required repeated surgeries. But it always came back, often more aggressive and pernicious. This time, however, I performed the most radical operation yet, my entire Updike collection. It took 3 cab rides, but in a few hours I managed to transport all 3 shelves to a New York dealer. Traveling down Park Avenue in a cab a week later, a little red leather box nestled in my lap, I felt purged and absolved. All the heartache and the wisdom and the weakness I'd absorbed through those books had been boiled down to something eternal and pure, a wedding ring.
You say that an interview is not an actual conversation, and you refer to it as it's like a version of a conversation and has the same relationship to talking as fiction does to life. Within that kind of artifice, then, how do you get the good stuff out of writers? How do you get them to talk to you and be real and not blur the lines between who they are as people and who they are as writers?
Well, I think it's a performance of intimacy. And if you go to performances on the stage, people are doing the same thing. They're performing drama, they're performing heartbreak, they're performing rage, and it feels every bit as real as what you see in your real life. It's sometimes even more real. And yet it's a performance, it's a fiction. And I think novelists, because they are taking what happens from their life and throwing their voice, extrapolating their experience into the lives of another, they are basically, when they talk about their work, they're building a bridge from their own life to the work, which is every bit as invisible as it is intimate. And I think the good novelists, the ones I felt like putting in this book, are the ones where that footbridge feels like it's made of air, you know, and yet it's solid. It's something that makes you want to read their work, and it makes you feel that they're also an individual. My wife and I divorced in the autumn. She had moved to California, and the laws of Maine, where we had married, required one of us to be present during the final proceedings. I drove up from New York alone and spent the night with my soon-to-be ex-laws in their house on the beach, eating the saddest lobster dinner I've ever had. The next morning, I drove to the court with my mother-in-law, who waited outside the empty chambers while I cut the thin legal string that still connected me to her daughter. I didn't drive directly home. That afternoon, by a fluke of scheduling, I had arranged to interview John Updike at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. At some point, I must have begun to flag, however, because he turned to me and asked, "Is this enough? I mean, you look pretty tired. I understand you're coming from Vermont." I told him it was not Vermont, but Maine, and in response to the question about what I was doing up there, I said I was getting divorced. The museum tour came to a dead halt. Updike faced me with real feeling, his ironic pose collapsing. "I'm really sorry," he said. He would not allow me to make light of my newly minted divorce, and said that he had gone through this once before too, which I knew, and that it was hell. His advice continued briefly, but it was so surreal to hear him reference his private life that I can hardly remember what he said.
When you describe the idea of meeting writers, you use the word electrifying, which is such a big word, and yet anybody who loves books knows what you mean by that. Why did you describe it that way?
Because a novelist makes these invisible worlds that feel every bit as real to us as our own lives, and it's somehow spooky when you meet the person who made the world, and they have personality traits which have an echo of the book. And so it's like watching the book turn to flesh. And when you meet them, there is that kind of out-of-body experience that you have, as if you're meeting a creator. And you don't have to be a believer to have that hair standing up on the back of your neck feeling. It's not a celebrity. It's not someone whose image you've seen before. It's the uncanny feeling of seeing someone who you don't think has an image because they've made images for you. Real. I convinced the publicist to let me go ahead with the assignment. John Updike and I sat in a conference room so high up over Midtown Manhattan it felt like riding in a helicopter. In between bites of a turkey sandwich, Updike described what he saw on 9/11. I wore my nicest suit, in fact, the one I got married in. I did not mention this detail to Updike, and just once did I interrupt the snowfall of his verbal prose poems to ask him if he had read the Quran. He had, and then described it with beauty and grace. It was a perfect Updike moment, powerful and contained, only the littlest bit strange. He would have nothing to do with its shaping or its meaning in either my fiction or my life. That would be up to me.
And that was John Freeman reading from How to Read a Novelist, which is published by Macmillan. Thanks for tuning in to The Book Show. If you want to listen back, we're on rte.ie, iTunes and SoundCloud. We're not on air next week, but back on Saturday, April 5th at 7 p.m. The Book Show is produced by Zoe Cummins, and we leave you tonight with a footnote by Regan Hutchins.
At the time of his death in 1940, writer F. Scott Fitzgerald... Fitzgerald, author of The Great Gatsby, died a penniless, alcoholic, failed Hollywood scriptwriter, an all-but-forgotten name.
Never heard of him.
His books weren't selling, and in 1936, The New Yorker magazine rejected one of his short stories, The Darling of the Jazz Age, whose debut novel, This Side of Paradise, brought him overnight fame, died aged 44, and his last royalty check amounted to $13. Refusing to pay for them, his papers were donated to Princeton University, where they're now valued at $10 million. The Great Gatsby has enjoyed repeated success in film, theatre, and has more than one computer game. Oh, and it currently sells 500,000 copies a year.
The Book Show was presented by Sinead Gleeson.